Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Angie Coiro, host of Live from the Left Coast, and I'm your moderator for tonight's program. It is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest. Jeff Charlotte is author of the New York Times bestseller, The Family, and most recently, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. His special interest is America's religious subcultures, and that is reflected in the two online journals he's created, Killing the Buddha and The Revealer. He is also a contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone. You'll find his work in Mother Jones, New York Magazine, The Washington Post, and many more traditional and new media outlets. And for most readers, 2008's The Family was their first exposure to this fundamentalist Christian group's entrenchment in the U.S. government. And with this new book, he probes further into the family's congressional ties, its reach into Uganda's war on gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, and its permeation of America's military. Please welcome Jeff Charlotte.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, and it's good to be with you all tonight. I think that the reason I am with you tonight, I've been writing about religion and politics for a long time, and looking at a lot of different aspects of these intersections where religion and politics meet in the public square. But this one story of C Street, I think, is what brings us together tonight. The story that begins last summer, some of you may remember, in the summer of 2009, when three conservative politicians, all of them champions of what they described as family values, very publicly detonated their marriages. First, we had Senator, some of you remember. It's not nice to laugh at somebody's detonating their marriage, but they seemed determined to make us laugh. First, we had Senator John Ensign, who was then the fourth-ranking Republican, a man with Iowa and beyond on the mind, a guy who thought he could be president, who confessed to an adulterous affair. Then there was Governor Mark Sanford, who was an even brighter presidential prospect until he redefined the Appalachian Trail as leading all the way down to Argentina and into the arms of his mistress. And last, and I say this with probably not enough charity in my heart, at least in really every way, was an unusually powerful but little-known congressman named Chip Pickering from Mississippi, who was a very effective guy. He was one of the architects of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which sort of led to one of the great consolidations of media, disastrous effects on journalism, and I would argue the sort of the very concept of free speech, what it means to have a lively debate in the public square. But no one really paid attention to that. No one knew about his role in that. If you know who Chip Pickering is at all, if you happen to see, there was a satirical movie a couple years ago, Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, in which Sacha Baron Cohen, playing the idiot reporter Borat, makes his way to a revival meeting where Pickering takes to the pulpit to proclaim himself a loyalist of the gathering and its truths, creationism and religious nationalism, America the Christian. America as a Christian nation, as a nation selected by God to embody a certain Protestant and subset of Protestant, a certain evangelical theology, America as a Christian nation was something that all three men believed in or paid lip service to as part of the politics of fundamentalism. And I always want to make that distinction because we have to remember fundamentalism, the tradition of Christian fundamentalism, is itself a very small d democratic tradition. It's not an authoritarian tradition at all. It begins with the sort of the radical idea that no church, no preacher can tell me how to read the Bible. I'm going to do it myself. When I speak of the politics of fundamentalism, I speak of the transfer of this at the individual level, very democratic, very modest idea into the political sphere and the projection that while no one's going to tell me how to engage with God, I'm going to tell you how to do it. So that's what I mean by the politics of fundamentalism. But all three of these guys were united more than ideologically, which is sort of what made them a story, something different than the usual sort of ebb and flow of scandal and revelation. All three scandals were linked to this red brick townhouse on Capitol Hill, 133 C Street, Southeast. I always give the address because it's tax exempt as a church. IRS has criteria if you want to be church, if you want to be tax exempt. One of the things you have to do is you have to be open to the public to worship. So next time you're in Washington, it's a pretty wild place, as you can tell from these three guys. It's beautifully located across from the Library of Congress, down the street from a congressional office building. The Supreme Court's this way. But it's more than just a clubhouse. The C Street House, or the Prey Boy Mansion, as some bloggers began calling it, it's the Capitol Hill headquarters of the oldest and I think arguably the most influential Christian conservative political organization in America, which is known variously as the Fellowship, the Prayer Breakfast Movement, or to its octogenarian leader as the Family. Senator Ensign lived in the C Street House during the period he was having his affair and turned to the C Street House to help him cover it up, arrange for payments to his mistress. Governor Sanford retreated there for help and managing his wife, Jenny Sanford, when she discovered his affair. And her account of what happened, she describes being sent to C Street herself to talk to C Street, the men of C Street, when her marriage was on the rocks. Governor Sanford said, talk to the men of C Street. They'll spiritually counsel you. They explained to her that as his wife, her job was to not trouble him, not to raise her voice in anger, that he may have been straying and going astray, but that was a matter to be dealt with between men. The men would get together and settle that for her. And then again, last and again least, Congressman Pickering, who not only lived in the C Street House, but according to the divorce papers filed by his wife, rendezvoused with his mistress there, who was a telecom heiress, conveniently enough. In 2008, he left Congress to become a telecom lobbyist. So there's sort of a happy ending on that story, except for his wife and five sons. Other residents of the C Street House, all enjoying subsidized rent in a house that is tax-free because it's registered as a church, have included Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, lives there now, man very much in the news as the gatekeeper of the Tea Party. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, who's about to become governor of that state. His Senate seat will almost definitely be taken by Representative Jerry Moran, who also lives in C Street, and beat out another C Streeter, Representative Todd Tehart. Kansas is kind of an all C Street kind of delegation. Heads, C Street wins. Tails, C Street wins. There's also Representative Zach Womp, a Republican of Tennessee, former Representative Steve Largent, and Senator Tom Coburn, the Oklahoma Republican infamous for proposing the death penalty for abortion providers. Senator Coburn, by the way, is a doctor himself, you may know, and explaining why he didn't feel he needed to discuss the role he had played in negotiating payments to Ensign's mistress wife, payments that are now subject of a Justice Department investigation. He said, well, I have medical confidentiality with Senator Ensign. Some of you, I think, know the punchline. He's an obstetrician, so we're waiting the happy announcement from Senator Ensign. Now, you know, there's some giggles to be had from stories of political sex scandals, but it's important to remember that if all these men wanted to live together and pray together and even keep each other's secrets, that's fine. That's fine. They're entitled to do that. That's what the First Amendment is there for. If they want to study the Bible together and bring it into their political lives, that's fine too. That's their religious freedom. We have to respect that, protect that. The issue becomes when they're doing this through the auspices of a private and very sectarian religious organization that has resisted all attempts at transparency. And as I speak today, there's an article in today's Roll Call, which is sort of the very wonky newspaper on the Hill for political folks, and they pointing out that this organization, the Family, is linked to some funds and, of all things, a terrorism case. Some money was laundered through the organization. the organization said, "That how dare you suggest that about us?" A roll call said, "Okay, show us the records." And they said, "Oh, we can't do that." That's the problem. Here's an organization that is providing housing, providing counseling, helping congressmen cover up their affairs, and they're doing this without transparency. The longtime leader of the organization, a man named Doug Coe, tries to explain why this is so. He says, and I'm quoting, "The more invisible you make your organization, the more influence it will have." But, you know, in Washington, there's a lot of groups like that flying below the radar. I mean, we have lobbying and disclosure laws. The family in its early days said, "Hey, maybe we should register as a Christian lobby." And the founder said, no, we'll be much more effective if we can work behind the scenes. That's true, not terribly ethical, but not also that unusual in Washington. It's that the more influence we'll have, it's the nature of that influence that I think leads us to ask questions. And again, not questions about conspiracies or anything like that. Remember, the First Amendment protects these guys. They're entitled to do this. This is a religious movement. But because they're politicians who are saying they make the decisions based on their understanding of their religion, it's a legitimate and respectful question to ask them, "Well, what do you mean when you say that, as they do, that you turn to Jesus plus nothing, to think about how to approach politics?" Well, let me again turn to Doug Coe, and in fact, back actually a little bit further to the origins of the group. The group actually began, had its roots nearby in San Francisco, way back, 1934, a giant strike in San Francisco that terrified a preacher named Abraham Verrady, saw organized labor as a kind of satanic front, saw the New Deal as the destruction of America, and saw the Great Depression. He had come to believe that the Great Depression was a punishment from God for human interference with the market. He took the invisible hand of the market. He took it very literally. And he took a lot of things literally. One night in April 1935, he believed that God came to him. And this isn't sort of a dim collection. God walked into the room and said, "Abraham, for 2,000 years, Christianity has been getting it wrong. It's been all about the poor, the suffering, the weak, the down and out. That's nice, but that's not what it's about, Abraham. I want you to be a missionary to what Abraham would come to call the up and out, not the down and out, the up and out. He'll come to call them the top men, the key men, the powerful men." Now, he hadn't forgotten the poor and the weak, but he came to believe that the best way to help the weak is to help the strong, that God had chosen who he wanted to be rich and who he wanted to be poor. Our job was to help them do the right thing, to help the power, help the powerful have more power, to help them do the right thing. And the blessings would kind of come down to God through them and to the rest of us, sort of a trickle-down religious effect. That trickle-down is no mistake, because from the very beginning, their main focus was economics, this idea that some in the group, not all, but some would come to call biblical capitalism, the idea that a very radically unregulated market was somehow biblically foreordained. But they went further, drawing on the 19th century tradition known as muscular Christianity. They didn't like churches of the day. They didn't like churches of the day. Too many women in churches, too many sissies, they thought, weak-willed men. They wanted a more vital, manly thing, and they developed this idea of a very strong Christ. Their Jesus plus nothing is a strong man. Let me give you a direct quote from Doug Coe, and this is the very idea that they began with in the beginning. He says, "You say, 'Hey, you know, Jesus said you got to put him before mother, father, brother, sister.'" And that's in the Bible. "Hitler, Lenin, Mao, that's what they taught the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own mother and father, but it wasn't murder. It was for building the new nation, the new kingdom." Now, if this was a one-time instance, I'd say, well, that is a poor choice of words. But my first encounter with the group, writing about this for Harper's Magazine, was living with them for a month, and I would encounter the sort of daily drumbeat of the leadership lessons of Hitler and Mao. Now, you see the ideological breadth there. This isn't about fascism. It's not about communism. It's about strength. It's about the fetishization of strength. It's about reading the New Testament in a radically different way than almost every Christian out there does. This is not a Christ recognizable in most American churches. It's a Christ that's about strength. And I heard it then, and then I went into their archives, 592 boxes of documents stored at the Billy Graham Center archives. No one had really gone digging through them. They had just dumped them there thinking no one would look at them, and sort of uncovered this sort of whole history of what I call the avant-garde of American fundamentalism, the elite fundamentalism, not the tent revivals, not the mass movements, but this very small group focused on elites. And, you know, that focus on elites is worth thinking about when you think of that quote, you know, this idea, this fetishization of strength, the Hitler language. There's a video sermon you can find online working with NBC Nightly News. We've got a video sermon of Doug Coe, and he's sort of describing the great political friendship, that this could be a model for you in your life and working with your friends, the great friendship of Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler. Now, bad guys, he says they're bad guys. Don't mistake them. These aren't neo-Nazis. But look at how much they got done. One time I spoke to a leader of the group and I said, you know, I'm troubled by all this Hitler talk. He said, no, no, Jeff, it's not the ends we admire. It's the methods. Thank you. I'm glad you see the problem with that. Now, another man associated with the group, in fact, on that NBC broadcast finally came out. The group is secretive, but not completely secret. Came out and said, boy, better defend ourselves. It says, all this stuff about Hitler, it's just a metaphor. It's just a metaphor. And, you know, when sometimes people try to look at this story and say, well, Jeff, you know, you're being anti-religious, anti-Christian, and I say, well, I speak in churches all the time, and I've never been in a church that couldn't think of a better metaphor for Jesus than Hitler. There's a lion. You want something more exciting? Or a lion, there's a lamb. You know, there's a whole history. But Jesus plus nothing throws away that history. It throws away theology. It even throws away, at the heart of the group, morality. Morality, they say, morality is kid stuff. That's a quote from the leader. Morality doesn't apply to the leaders, the powerful, who are put in position by God. And you take that metaphor, you take that rhetoric, and it all sounds kind of crazy, but what does it mean in the world? Well, one thing it means is you take a John Ensign, they believe he's anointed by God. If some of you are familiar with Ensign's career, he probably had to be. He was not the brightest bulb on the porch. Something was helping him get there. But they believe he's anointed by God. It's not that they endorse this affair, but they're going to help him stay there. They're going to help the weak by helping the strong. They're going to help the weak by helping John Ensign. And you take that metaphor and you project it out a little bit further. And that's what I did in this new book and why I wanted to return to this. The last book was mostly history. New book is about the present moment. I didn't want to just focus on the sex scandals. I wanted to follow the ideas and the money out of C Street. I was able to do that because a lot of people within the organization who were looking at what they were involved in said, hey, we've gone terribly astray. The son of one of the original leaders is now speaking out to Christian Right magazine saying, this thing has gone off the rails. This is a perversion of everything we stood for. And I think you can see that very evidently. When we follow the money out, one character I followed, Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who I have a special soft spot for because he's so candid. He's so honest. You know, a lot of the men were trying to defend C Street and saying, oh, don't, it's just a personal place, no politics going on here. Senator Inhofe pipes up, I don't know what they're talking about. I hold political meetings there. We started looking at the way the family was funding foreign junkets for congressmen to go over and meet with heads of state whom they were coming back to the United States and sort of lobbying for. And again, a number of the congressmen involved says, oh, it's just about making friends. These lonely congressmen, nobody else to hang out with on a Saturday night, but maybe the dictator of Sudan. Inhofe again was candid. He says, I don't know what they're talking about. He says, I go to promote the political philosophy of Jesus as taught to me by Doug Coe. And then in case you were wondering how do you match that up with the separation of church and state, well, you don't. He calls the separation of church and state the phoniest idea there ever was. That's his quote. He says, and I do it on your tax dime. He charges us. He charges us. And he goes to places like the first trip he describes going to in 1998 to Nigeria to meet the late dictator of that very oil-rich nation, which the United States wanted to put sanctions on, but a small group of senators, Inhofe among them, fought those sanctions because in Inhofe's case, he had spent time with Abacha and just saw that he was a real brother in Christ. Inhofe, by the way, does quite well with oil himself. He's a winner of Lifetime Achievement Award from the petroleum industry. It's his big backer. And he vouched for Abacha, who incidentally died not too long after that in bed with three prostitutes. Inhofe is not the worst. Maybe the worst is former Congressman Mark Siljander, who I referred to at the beginning of the talk, the money. Congressman Mark Siljander, leader of the group, pled guilty in July to obstruction of justice and acting as an unregistered agent of a foreign power. Money was being filtered from a banned terrorist organization secretly headquartered in Sudan. This is all the government's indictment. Through being laundered through the nonprofits of this organization, and he in turn was going over there to Sudan to speak with Omar al-Bashir, who was the first sitting head of state ever to be indicted for genocide. You've probably heard of what's going on in Darfur. So had former Congressman Siljander, who said things got a little out of hand there. But he went on Christian Right TV and he said, Bashir melted my heart. And he's Muslim, but I talked to him about Jesus, and I think he's very open to hearing that message. And so we have to remain open to him. That means no sanctions. No, we're going to lobby against sanctions. At C Street, we've reached this point where piety and corruption have become almost one and the same. And I say that not to say one is the cover for the other, but to look at someone like Siljander or Inhofe or Ensign and Coburn, what most of us looking at this would say, hey, there's an element of corruption to what you're doing. And Siljander, who's facing 15 years in prison, more than an element, they experience as piety. Coburn perverting the public trust, distorting the truth to cover for his friend, says, hey, I'm being loyal to my brother. And you want to say to this representative of the people, the senator, what about being loyal to us, the people who sent you to Washington, the people who put you there? I want to close with just a very short passage from the book that I think sort of puts this all in perspective. This is something going on right now. You know, when I talk about these other examples, these are things that are long past. Do I have time just to read a short passage? When I think we talk about American fundamentalism, we can look at things like these sort of the scandals. We can talk about policy initiatives, things that have grown out of C Street, and probably here in the room, we have very different ideas on whether or not those were good things. But we want to look, I think we can probably all be in agreement that sometimes the projection of power, the long shadow of American fundamentalism overseas, and that's one of the ways this group differs from the conventional Christian right. They're very internationalist in focus. And in fact, in recent years, they have been very focused on Africa, pouring millions of dollars into these countries for what they call leadership development, trying to help these countries become a leadership led by God, trying to create the Christian nation that they can't here in America because we do have that First Amendment. Senator Inhofe in particular has been very active with this, not just in Nigeria, but in Uganda. Uganda, which is quite an important nation, actually, to the United States. We've given billions of dollars, with a B, to this country. They are becoming increasingly a military hub for what is a big military buildup. And they're really on the front lines as we look at this kind of the struggle between democracy and what you might want to call radical and militant Islam. They're close by Somalia, where that fight is being fought now. Their troops are there fighting as proxies for us. But something else is going on in Somalia, something called the Anti-Homosexuality Bill. This is a bill that was introduced into the parliament there by a member of parliament named David Bahati, who kind of cut his political teeth in Washington and Arlington. In fact, I said I'd lived with the group for a while. He was in the same place. I didn't know him then. It was different times. He had been to C Street. He had been inspired by them to go back to Uganda and become a congressman for God. He was motivated by Senator Inhofe, who would visit regularly, who he said would explain to him how to make Uganda a Christian nation. John Ashcroft would come and visit this group of members of parliament, 60 strong in Uganda. In Uganda, they were doing what they couldn't really do here, and he finally came up with a piece of legislation that he thought would act on everything he'd learned. He was very impressed, again, as I said, by Inhofe. Inhofe, you got to know, by the way, is probably the most anti-gay politician out there. He took to the floor of the Senate one time with a picture of his kids and grandchildren. He says, I want everyone to know this is very important for the debate, that I have no homosexuality and divorce in my family. That was important for the debate. He says he won't hire gay people because it's a conflict of interest. His brother at C Street, Senator Tom Coburn, has described gay people as the greatest threat to American democracy. It's not fundamentalism, it's the gays. And Uganda, they acted on this with a bill that would simply provide the death penalty for homosexuality. 7 years in prison for promotion. This conversation I'm having with you now would be that. 3 years in prison if any of you in the room here are a heterosexual and know a homosexual person and don't report that person within 24 hours, whether or not it's your son or brother or father, sister, 3 years in prison. It's the most draconian anti-gay bill in the world. Nothing comes close to it. And if it passes and has enormous support there. The idea is not to stop in Uganda, but to work through these family political units and the parliaments of other African nations, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi. The idea is to purge Africa of homosexuality. So I got to talking to this guy who came up with this idea on the phone. He invited me to Uganda. When someone who's thinking of genocide invites you for lunch, you should go, because that will be interesting, unless you become lunch. So I went over to see David Bahati and spend some time with him. And I said, David, is there any connection between the family and your bill? And he says, no connection. It is. The family is the bill. We did it. Now, before I just read this passage, I should say the American politicians have said that's not what we meant. And some people in the family have even taken steps to work against this. That's the good news. They know things have gotten out of hand there. But there's a little bit of a responsibility lag, a problem here. They say, hey, we didn't pull any triggers in Uganda. We didn't kill anybody. And that's true. They built the gun. They built the gun and they put it on the table and say, hey, what you do with it, it's not our problem. And in fact, David Bahati told me, he says he's never received any pressure from them to drop this. So, but I want to turn around, instead of talking about these guys, turn around at what's at stake with a very short scene of a person named Victor Mikasa, an activist, born Juliet Mikasa, lives as a man, but like many Ugandan gay activists, is very devout. It's a very devout nation. As a child, Juliet Mikasa knew she was attracted to children of the same sex, and she had been raised Catholic but had joined an American-style Pentecostal church, hoping that in the music and the dancing and the Holy Ghost, the ecstasy, she would find the resolution of her desires. But Juliet Mikasa was not skilled at leading two lives. She dressed as Victor. She couldn't think dressed like a girl. She called herself Victor Mikasa. A pastor determined that she was possessed by a male spirit, asked his flock to help him heal her. The exorcism took place at the altar in front of 1,000 Christians, boys and men from the church's healing ministry, laying on hands and speaking in tongues as women in the pews swayed and sang for Mikasa's liberation, as the pastor called it, her freedom. They took her arms, gently, then firmly, and then they held her and stripped her. Slowly, garment by garment, praying over each piece of demonically infused cloth, she had bound her breasts. They bared them. I cried, and every time I cried, they would call it liberation. They slapped her, but it was holy slapping, they said. And when she stood before them, completely naked, the men's hands roaming over her body, they said that was holy too. Then they locked her in a room and raped her for a week. This is known as a corrective, a medical procedure, a cure. When it was all over, the pastor declared that the church had freed Mikasa, and maybe in a sense it had. Victor Mikasa no longer believed there was a demon inside him. The demons were in that church. Mikasa became a man and an activist, determined to prevent what had happened to him from happening again. In 2003, he co-founded an LGBT rights group called Freedom in Rome, Uganda. In 2005, Ugandan police, led by government officials, raided his house. They didn't find Mikasa, but a friend, Yvonne Oyu, was there. They took her down to the station. They stripped her. You look like a man, they said. We're going to prove you're a woman. It happened again. Mikasa fled, but in hiding and then in exile he planned. The plan was not lesbian, it was not gay, it was human. It was a citizen's plan. Mikasa sued, and never was a lawsuit more like a gift of the spirit, the romance of the rule of law. I'll end there because that's one of the few happy endings in this book. He won. He won the lawsuit. And this country that is preparing is on the brink where the idea of genocide has been set on simmer. He won the lawsuit. There is still the rule of law. If the law is changed, you institutionalize the killing of gay people. But until then, you can't kick down doors without a search warrant. Due process won the day. And I like to think about that because it's so small and it's not a grand victory and so on. But it's what I think of as the noise of democracy. And this is where I'll end. The noise of democracy. The founder of the family, and explaining why he was going to do group places like C Street, these closed door places, he said, "I'm going to help congressmen make decisions beyond the din of the vox populi, beyond the voice of the people." He said, "We have reached the age of minority control. A few key men will make those decisions." Well, I go back further than that to James Buchanan, not ringing any bells, perhaps the worst president in United States history, president up to 1861 when things got out of hand. Didn't really run things very well, but he had one good statement. People at that time were talking, there was a sentiment, well, we should have bipartisanship at any cost. We should have harmony. We should not disagree. That the ruling class should be united on one thing. And he says, no, that's not the idea here. He says, I like the noise of democracy. I don't like the harmony of democracy. I like the noise. I like the debate, the sharp elbows. That's Victor Mikasa in Uganda brought the noise of democracy. And I think in trying to write about this, and looking at all the journalists and scholars out there who are approaching this question from many different angles, I'm so fond of a Christian right magazine called World. They're a very conservative fundamentalist magazine, and they have taken the lead on investigative reporting on this because they don't like it when someone says Hitler's a metaphor for Jesus. They don't like it when someone funnels money, launders money. They're bringing the noise of democracy, too. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with New York Times bestselling author Jeff Charlotte. A lot of questions for you, some coming from the audience. One is asking for a clarification of something you just discussed, and that is where the family stands on the Ugandan legislation. Do they have an official stance? Is there a divided stance?
They can't have an official stance because part of what, you know, for a long time this group, until 2009, the group denied that they existed. In fact, when I worked with NBC News, the producer there called up one of the leaders of the group and said, "You know, I want to talk about your organization." "Oh, there's no organization, nothing at all, just a group of friends." And he said, "Well, we've been reviewing your tax records for a few days. Most groups of friends don't have 501c3s with massive budgets. Although the family, it was about friends. They had there was a sort of a one item in the budget, $12 million for making friends." I don't know about your friends, but I'd be their friend for $12 million. So they don't. They really cling to this idea of themselves as decentralized, and that's part of the problem. In fact, one leader of the family, who's a thoughtful guy, and he doesn't support this thing in Uganda, but he says we've always had a tension between access and accountability, and it was very important to them to have access to power because they felt themselves missionaries to power. But if you hold power accountable, well, then maybe you don't get in. You don't get in the door. So they don't challenge power. And they said, if we were to hold power accountable, then we wouldn't be able to have the good influence. And I said, look what's about to happen in Uganda. You know, we pay lip service to this idea of never again, and here we are on the brink. When's the accountability part coming? When do you use this access? So there is no official position. The leader of the family, Doug Coe, has said he doesn't like this idea. But there's actually kind of a conflict because having empowered this guy in Uganda, who is a beneficiary of the programs they're doing and is the leader of the group, he said he brought the bill to them before he introduced it. He says he got a green light. They say, well, we kind of subtly tried to imply and maybe it's not a good idea. So they're saying two different things, but the reality is, you know, I spoke to not just him, but a number of guys said, we haven't received any pressure from the Americans. And right as the book went to press, a leader of the family called me, trying to, in effect, distance himself from this. He says, you know, they're not even, Bahati's not our most powerful guy there. We have the Friday group. That's the power group. It's led by an American and a Ugandan who is as good as an American because he does what you tell him. That was their description. And I said, of course, we can call the president, Museveni, anytime we want, but we haven't. So the official position, it almost kind of lacks any substance. There's no there in this gospel. There's no to borrow from the Christian tradition. There's no sense of speaking truth to power. There's none of the great prophetic tradition of Christianity.
One of the things I've had trouble wrapping my mind around, I followed your work, I followed the whole issue of Christian dominionists, the Christian activists within religions. And one of the toughest things for me to wrap my mind around that you finally clarified in your book, Sea Street, is how people who claim to be Christian can do so many lying, cheating, you know, the things that, you know, anti-commandment sort of things.
Yeah.
And in your book, you clarified why this particular group of Christians believes that they are above morality. And it's a very ugly anecdote.
Yeah.
This is
what really drew. You know, I had written this book about the history of it, and when the whole thing broke, magazine editor said, "I want to kind of sit and face you. Is this going to pick me up enough?" Okay, good. I feel like I'm sort of talking like this. A magazine editor called me up, said, "Do you want to write about Senator Anson?" I said, "No, I don't. You know, that guy's problems are his own. So I'm not interested in counting his sins." And then, you want to write about Governor Sanford? No, I didn't want to do that. It was when, after Sanford confessed a few days later, explaining why he wasn't going to resign, even though he had called on President Clinton to do the same in similar circumstances. Well, Bill Clinton's just a president. Mark Sanford is kind of more like a king. King David, in fact, he said. This is talking to his staff. He says, "I'm like King David." He says, now, King David, keep in mind, King David does some bad things, right? King David wasn't always a hero. There's the story that they're talking about, the story of seducing Bathsheba. King David sees a beautiful woman. He has his guards bring her to him. He seduces her, and then he wants to get rid of her husband, so he sends them off to the front lines and says, make sure he doesn't make it back. This is a terrible thing. So Mark Sanford's thinking, well, geez, I didn't kill anybody, you know, but that was his justification, and that sort of just gave me a chill because I had encountered that. That was actually one of my introductions to the group, and as I would learn over the years of reading through these tens of thousands of documents, really a core part of the theology. When I encountered it, it was through a man named David Coe, son of the leader Doug Coe, and a leader himself in the movement. He was explaining leadership to a group of young men being groomed for leadership, and he was saying, why do we revere King David? And one man says, because he's a good guy, and David Coe says, no, remember this Bathsheba thing? And I got the answer right. I said, he's chosen. I said, yeah, he's chosen. And then to illustrate this to us, he says to one young man, he says, suppose I hear you raped three little girls. What would I think of you? And the young man, being a human being, says, you think I'm a monster. And David Coe says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. You're one of us. Now, again, these guys aren't neo-Nazis, and they're not advocating rape. But what they're saying is, whether or not you do those things, you are, in effect, above the rules. And he went on to make that very explicit. As I said, he said, morality is kid stuff. Chosenness is what matters. He says, we elect our leaders, but that doesn't matter. Jesus elects his. The chosen ones, the new chosen, as they sometimes call themselves, with the idea that the Jews have broken their covenant with God and are no longer the chosen people. The new chosen are above all those rules. And I think that's really the sort of the most terrifying aspect of this. And I think, again, just to emphasize, you said why, you know, people call themselves Christians. I should say, by the way, the core of the group does not call themselves Christians. They say that's a political term, and it's misleading when you're trying to reach out to bring other people in. They don't call themselves Christians, but you know, those who do call themselves Christians don't recognize that idea. I think it's always important to really emphasize this. What this group is doing is not within the mainstream of American evangelicalism. The theology that they have developed over 75 years is something radically different, and which is why I think you've seen a lot of Christian groups at the forefront of challenging them.
Some of this idea of morality being kid stuff is at play in the U.S. military. And about a third of your book is devoted to showing the influence of the family and of the same mentality as the family at work in the military, to the point that the enlisted people suffer deeply in ways that any of us would consider immoral.
Yeah, absolutely. That's I spent about a year traveling around the country. I went to all the military service academies, West Point, Annapolis. I spent a long time at the Air Force Academy, which is really at the heart of this problem in the military that has gotten so out of control that one three-star general who remembers his oath to protect and defend the Constitution, in describing the situation, he just sighed and used language that I can't even use because it's going to be on the air. He said, "This is an effing clown show." He says, "We've got senior officers promoted on the basis of religious beliefs, not merit. We have strategies and tactics based on the Book of Revelation. We have the 15,000-member-strong Officers Christian Fellowship." Now, I should say many people within that group are just very good officers, but the leadership of this group defines its mission as, I'm quoting, "reclaiming territory for Christ within the military, not allowing the opposition, all of which is spearheaded by Satan, to stand in the way." And when they say all of which, they mean it. They go on in another document to describe military personnel who don't share their religious beliefs as unwitting spiritual terrorists. They describe the war in Iraq and Afghanistan as a spiritual war of the greatest magnitude. And here's where you start to see the danger this poses to people. And the story that I chose amongst the hundreds and hundreds that I encountered, speaking to military personnel of all ranks, the story I chose to really illustrate this was in Samarra in Iraq. I spoke to a number of soldiers involved in the incident. There was a Bradley. They were in a tight situation. They were under siege, a special forces unit. They took a Bradley fighting vehicle, which is essentially a fast-moving tank, and they had their Iraqi translator, their Arabic translator, paint on the side in big red Arabic letters, "Jesus killed Muhammad." And then they sent him up on the roof with a bullhorn, and he was to chant, "Jesus killed Muhammad, Jesus killed Muhammad. Muhammad was a pedophile." I spoke to the young lieutenant who drove the Bradley fighting vehicle. He says he didn't know what the words meant. The other soldiers who were there said they did, and they were angry. They were angry this was happening. They knew this was putting their lives at risk. This was making everyone the enemy. You go down a street, and he described this. I went down a street, and people would take pot shots at my tank. And, you know, so he decided that anyone who took a pot shot at the tank that says "Jesus killed Muhammad" driving down your street was the enemy. And he destroyed almost an entire civilian block. And I said, "How did you do this?" He misunderstood the question. He thought maybe, you know, he thought I guess was admiring it perhaps. He said, "I was spiritually armored because my chaplain had given me a special screening of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ that morning." I was, in effect, he meant was that he was bulletproof. And he's since been promoted, by the way, as has every officer I encountered. It's a real, real problem. It's a very sad problem because, as you said, especially the enlisted people, this is a problem that's kind of concentrated in the officer corps. There's a lot of enlisted troops, some of them fundamentalist Christians who just want to do their job. The vast majority of military personnel just wants to do their job. But they, and in terrible instances like this, are being coerced into somebody else's idea of holy war. And that's an idea that puts not just them at risk, but also us at risk. It's the idea that makes the propaganda of Al-Qaeda seem true to the Islamic world.
One of the themes that carries over from when you discuss the family at work in Congress and the family at work in the military and the same mentality at work in the military is the contradiction between the goals as stated of the military, as stated of the Congress, and as stated by the family. You talk about the vision of endless war, that those who subscribe to these theories say, we're essentially going to be in war until the second coming.
Well, it was one of the founders of Officers Christian Fellowship. He said, there's no problem in inflaming things. It's, Bible prescribes endless war.
So when a president says, you know, we are going to work to become a country of peace or to be at peace, that's in conflict with what some of the top brass believe is going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, just to bring the family back into it, it's sort of interesting because they describe their goal as endless peace. They just want us all to get along. Harmony. In one document, they said 200 world leaders bound together invisibly through bonds of the family. Well, that's not going to happen.
but they can do a lot of damage along the way. But, you know, in speaking with some of the folks, for instance, involved in Uganda, they were just sort of describing peace. They had been very involved with the leader there, President Museveni, who's been there 24 years, is a dictator at this point, didn't start as a dictator, was a kind of a leftist at the beginning, and their early document says, we've got to steer him away from the left and make this a Christian nation. They were the ones who facilitated U.S. foreign aid for that. And, you know, when I would raise criticisms of that, I said, but we helped bring peace to Uganda. And I said, what do you mean? He says, the peace of President Museveni's 24-year regime, the peace of a dictatorship. So you have the sort of the peace of the dictatorship on the one hand or the endless war on the other. And maybe that's, if I can just pick another illustration from that, one of the examples I talk about in the book to show how this sort of, how does this trickle down into the world, is an initiative, a faith-based initiative still going on, expanding, in fact, called Fugitive Safe Surrender, dreamed up by a U.S. Marshal who had the idea that the best way to get fugitives, and most fugitives, by the way, are not, you know, they're not Wild West characters. The vast majority of fugitives are poor folks with traffic violations that have gotten out of hand. He said, I want these people to turn themselves in. So what he did was he moved the entire city's legal system into a megachurch for 4 days. He got a grant from the Justice Department to do this. And then he put out advertising, turn yourself into the church. And if you don't, by the way, as he told me, he says, we're going to roll through the city like Baghdad. Armored cars, we're going to bust down doors. You have your choice. So I went to one. They've done these in cities all over the country now. It's an expanding program. I went to one in Akron, Ohio. It's always in an African-American community. This is for poor folks because, frankly, middle-class folks, we expect the justice system to work for us. We don't think we have to go to church and pray just to get a traffic ticket handled. But you went into this church, big mega church. The folks there were instructed not to proselytize, or so they said. So I said, is there any proselytizing going on here? And a church volunteer in the parking lot sort of reared back and said, what are you saying? She heard it's prostitution. They didn't. They had no idea. She says, but can I tell you about Jesus? Again, this is federal Justice Department money. You go in through a metal detector, and here's that thing, the peace of the dictatorship or the endless war. You go into the metal detector and they say, there's no violation of separation of church here because everybody has a choice. Nobody's being coerced. Waiting for you was a preacher with a Bible or a sheriff in riot gear. You had your choice. A man with a Bible or a man with a gun. It's totally up to you. You're free.
The makeup of the family is of interest to a number of our audience members, one of whom asks if the family is all Republican, if there's a bipartisan nature to the group. And let me expand on that and ask you, are we talking all white people? I know we're talking all well-off people, class-wise.
You know, part of the reason it's the oldest organization in America is unlike this, you know, the Christian Coalition, the Moral Majority, these age of sort of alliterative organizations, they rise and fall. They connect themselves too tightly to one political party. When those political fortunes collapse, out they go. Goodbye, Ralph Reed. The family has endured for 75 years because of this idea expressed by the leader. We work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. They are deeply, deeply pragmatic. Pragmatic in the service of power. And so they've always been mostly Republican, mostly conservative. In the early days, the Democrats included guys like Strom Thurmond, back when he was a Democrat, and my favorite Senator Absalom Willis Robertson, Dixiecrat of Virginia, and Pat Robertson's father. And today there's Democrats involved, too. In the C Street House, Bart Stupak, Congressman Bart Stupak, who nearly derailed the health care bill with his amendment against abortion, working with Joe Pitts, another longtime brother of the family, former Congressman Mike Doyle, or I'm sorry, not former, he's still there, Democrat from Pennsylvania, who in 2009 accompanied his C Street brother, Senator Coburn, on a mission to Lebanon, financed, again, by you, to meet and recruit, as Coburn did, what in the family they call Messianic Muslims. These are like Jews for Jesus. They're going over there and saying, hi, I'm a U.S. senator, and I want you to love Jesus. That's dangerous. Lebanon is always a country on the brink. So these Democrats involved, but and that's bipartisan. And if you value bipartisanship at any cost, including principles, if you're not interested in the noise of democracy, this is the group for you. This is the group that you will find a certain kind of harmony in. I should say there's even more liberal Democrats who, you know, will come out and say, you know, Al Gore came out and said, oh, I know that Doug Coe. He seems, you know, he's a nice guy. He's a very spiritual man. Doug Coe is a wonderfully nice man, one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. And it's one of the sort of the sorrows of political journalism that they that we get distracted by personality and forget that what we're talking about is politics.
Well, let's talk about the family and their connections through the various presidential administrations. Let's start with the Clintons and Hillary Clinton, both Bill and Hillary Clinton, any connections to the Bush family, connections to the Obama administration?
Hillary Clinton's a kind of an interesting example of the way it works. When she came to Washington, she's the first lady. They wanted to know her. She said Doug Coe. She writes in her memoir, Doug Coe reached out to her. She describes Coe as a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. This, by the way, remember, is the man who says, model your friendships on that great buddy-buddy relationship between Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler. But Hillary never heard that language. They organized a prayer cell for her. That's their language going back to the 40s, which they borrowed from communism. They admired the organizing techniques of communism. A prayer cell for conservative women, Jack Kemp's wife, Jim Baker's wife, a conservative Democrat named Tony Hall, his wife, and a couple other people. There's not a whole lot of political there. I don't think the politics really got involved until the Senate. She kind of used it as, and I'm not attacking Hillary Clinton, actually. She used it as a sort of liaison to the right. I spoke with Senator Sam Brownback about how it had worked. He worked with her. He wanted to take the human trafficking issue and redefine it, narrow it down just to the issue of sex trafficking. And what was important to him was the sort of the moral purity of the thing, that no money in the fight against sex trafficking should go to any NGO that does not condemn prostitution. It doesn't seem a big deal to condemn prostitution until you consider that a lot of these organizations are trying to work with prostitutes, you know, a 13-year-old child prostitute in Thailand, to get them to come in for health care, for counseling, and so on. Probably the best way to lead is not to, I condemn you, at the front of the door. And a lot of Christian right leaders started praising Hillary Clinton for that. So she shifted a little bit to the right, but this is not to say she's not a stealth fundamentalist. She is what she looks like. I mean, you know, and I think what you see in that is the kind of, as a political movement, this is what that effect has, is to me, is not to, you know, kind of do any kind of sort of secret finagling, but to just sort of slowly shift the center rightward. And the rest of the spectrum sort of slouches afterwards, if the center is always moving rightward. And I think that was that relationship. You also asked about Bush. Not much of a relationship, actually, kind of antagonistic. And I think Bush's religion was always misunderstood. It was a fairly straightforward, simple religion. He did not have a lot of time for thinking about it. Because, you know, his mind was so filled with other ideas. But, you know, here's this organization that's been there. You know, they host the annual National Prayer Breakfast. A lot of people think that's a public event. Maybe they think that because your invitation comes on congressional letterhead, and if you're a journalist, you RSVP to the White House. In fact, it's completely owned by the family. And you look at the president always speaks. Goes back to 1953. Before that, they asked FDR, because they said, we want to consecrate the nation to Jesus. And FDR said, no. They asked Truman. Truman said no. They asked Eisenhower, and Eisenhower said no. But Eisenhower owed political favors. Billy Graham tells a tale in his memoir. He talks about how he had organized a vote for Eisenhower, which was significant at that time. Most American evangelicals were Southern Democrats, and they voted for this Republican. He said, will you please come to this event? And Eisenhower said, I'll go, but I hope it doesn't become a tradition. And of course it did, and it becomes impossible for any president not to go now, because it seems like you're against prayer. And meanwhile, what's grown up around it is this incredible complex. It's this great big lobbying festival. It goes on for a week with special seminars on the defense industry and Jesus, oil and Jesus. And I'm not just pulling out those arbitrarily. Those are the ones where it's been focused on for years. But by sort of cornering this virtuous language, they have been able to also create the space for the consecration of the nation to a Jesus, maybe not the Jesus most Christians would recognize, but this Christ of power.
What's interesting is that for anyone up to the time of the publication of your first book on the family, there was a kind of plausible deniability. Maybe the president didn't know the depth of it all, or at least had not been exposed as knowing the depth of it. But President Obama spoke to the National Prayer Breakfast after this came out, and Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington asked him not to speak there for the exact same reason, because of who it was sponsored by. What do you make of his deciding to speak there?
I mean, I don't hold it against him. I think there's nothing you can do. I mean, you can't, if he had not gone. The family, by the way, was very worried he wasn't going to go. That at issue was this man, David Bahati, the sponsor of the bill, who's been a prayer breakfast regular for many years. And now gay rights groups are saying, well, if this guy shows up, we're going to have protests. And in fact, there were protests for the first time in 2010. Gay rights groups, human rights groups. Bishop Gene Robinson, who was the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, came down. A lot of folks said, you know, this just is not appropriate. If you want to have a prayer breakfast, fine. Nothing wrong with a prayer breakfast. You can debate separation of church and state issues, but you have that debate in public. It should be publicly sponsored, not privately, by this organization. One evangelical or conservative Christian leader, Michael Cromartie, says, you know, they use it for access, and access they do get. You know, the family will pick a number of foreign leaders who want to meet with the president. The president's the figurehead. So Obama went, and actually one of the things he did, and I'm not a partisan on this, but he denounced the Uganda bill. And that was good. The sort of the sorrow of it was then the family said, okay, well, all taken care of. We're done with that. And the reality is that issue is still very much ongoing in that country and perhaps spreading out of Africa or through Africa. But I think, you know, when I talk about this, I always say, look, let's get beyond the focus. And while I liked what the Citizens Responsibility and Ethics in Washington did, I say, let's get beyond the focus on the personalities and say, let's talk about the ideas. In fact, let's engage them on these ideas. Is this an idea of Jesus that we want our leaders to subscribe to? They have religious freedom, but is that the idea that we want to vote for?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with New York Times bestselling author Jeff Charlotte. A number of times throughout this evening, you sprinkled in references to American taxpayer money, funding religious jaunts and funding activism, religious activism in other countries. Has anyone taken this bull by the horns and filed any sort of suit or sort of protest to say this is crossing the line?
Well, there's an interesting group that just actually came up with a new big statement today called Clergy Voice, based in Ohio. It's an interdenominational group of Christian pastors. And they began by challenging C Street's tax exempt status for the very reasons that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, these are pastors committed to their churches. And as far as they're concerned, C Street's giving church a bad name. And so they said, look, when it's tax exempt, remember, that means we're subsidizing. So rent at C Street, for instance, is $900 right now. And you get a room in this very centrally located, beautiful townhouse. There's a sort of a maid service provided by Christian college women, which you'd think that they might reconsider given events in the past. There's a cook. Your meals are prepared. It's a very lovely place. You have your pals drop by. Ollie North. Remember Ollie North? He kind of likes to hang out there. He does a fundraiser for the group, an annual fundraiser called God, Guys, and Guns. And they go on a duck hunt. So $900. Comparable rent this group determined was something like, I don't know, with all that, and on Capitol Hill right there, $3,000. Take that and extend it out 12 months or over the years, and now we're talking about felony levels of non-reported gifts. And if it's still seeming puzzling, why is this a problem? Just imagine if it was Shell Oil that said they did that. Hey, we're not going to try and influence them. We just want to help out these congressmen. As one leader of the group said, you know, a lot of congressmen, they don't make enough money to be able to afford rent, so we try to help them out. So our poor congressmen. Clergy Voice is an interesting group that's challenging this. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has been looking at it. They've been now filing a complaint against the tax-exempt status of the Fellowship Foundation, which is the big 501c3 that this thing is organized around. But there's still a lot of challenges. And those challenges take place, actually, I think, most effectively at the local level. And so I've been really impressed by all these journalists around the country who are just doing their jobs, asking their representatives tough choices. One of my favorite is out there in Kansas, Wichita, Kansas. Not exactly a liberal place. And the local TV news often gets a bad rap. Local TV news had heard that their congressman, Todd Tehart, was hanging around at C Street. I had reported on this, a conversation he'd had on how we can win the race with the Muslim. He thinks Muslims are having too many babies and we're not having enough. He wants to win the race with the Muslim. And so they decided to do an investigation. They just decided to ask some questions. I mean, that's just all that it takes. So those challenges, I think, are coming at the local level all over the country. I've seen it happen in Tennessee, North Carolina, Oklahoma. The reason we know about that taxpayer money with Jim Inhofe is that Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the newspaper, $187,000 minimum that he had spent on private missionary trips, not including the military transportation planes he was taking in the military escort.
And as far as what's happening in the military, one of the pushbacks is coming from the MRFF, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation.
Yeah, this is an interesting group founded by a man named Mikey Weinstein, who Air Force Academy grad, Air Force lawyer, not a liberal guy. He was a Reagan White House counsel, two sons in the Air Force Academy. They happened to be Jewish, and they encountered a lot of anti-Semitism, and it was around actually the time when Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ came out. The Air Force Academy had special advanced screenings that were mandatory. They were not supposed to be mandatory, but as an investigation later found, that was the effect that created. So he got concerned about this and sort of started creating this organization. And then military personnel of all religious persuasions started coming to him and telling him problems. And I went and talked to so many of these people. You know, there are sometimes little things, someone being forced to pray. I mean, that's so common at this point. You know, senior officers saying, now we're going to pray. And what are you going to do? You know, you can't challenge that. Really sad, sad cases of, I remember talking to one soldier, and he had lost a good friend in Iraq. He knew his friend was an atheist, and a colonel used the opportunity to say, this is a lesson for us all to come to Christ. And it just desecrated his friend's memory. I mean, the stories go on. And so this organization, MRF, sort of compiles all these and acts on them. And one of the connections with a family that sort of got me interested in the military aspect is I had, reporting on the family, I had found a video for an organization called Christian Embassy in the Pentagon. It featured senior flag officers testifying in uniform on duty in the Pentagon. They're offering their Christian testimony. And that's a, you know, you can be court-martialed for that, but here they are. I shared the video with this organization, and they pressed for a Department of Defense investigation, and they got one. And it confirmed that all this had happened, that this Christian Embassy group had been given security clearances. The one senior officer said, oh, I thought it was okay because they're a quasi-federal agency. This is how far gone we are from the First Amendment. You can even imagine that something called Christian Embassy could be a quasi-federal agency. There was this the report, but it was a whitewash. No one, in fact, most of the guys ended up getting promoted. I said, who is this inspector general? I wonder why he came to that conclusion. A guy named General Claude Kickletter. I took a closer look at him. He was on the board of directors of the Fellowship Foundation of the family. Well, that's a problem. Maybe that seems like a conflict of interest. But maybe more of a problem in his investigation of Christian Embassy, as it turned out, was the fact that he founded Christian Embassy. He had investigated himself and found himself not guilty. And when I talk about that convergence of piety and corruption, I can find no better illustration than that.
We've got time for only one more question. I'm going to make it a two-parter for you.
Okay.
What has changed about the family since your first book came out? And what is the best possible outcome in your mind of your new book? Best possible repercussions.
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Transparency. Transparency. This is not a left-right issue. And in fact, there's some within the movement who are in favor of transparency. And I think that's wonderful. And if anything, I'm sure they wouldn't look at it this way. I feel that they have perhaps been empowered by my work, by the pressure and the scrutiny that I and other journalists are bringing that it's time to go public. Now, they've announced that they're going to make a website, which I consider a rather cautious first step. You could go a lot further than that. What has changed, I think, for them is that they've faced a lot of scrutiny. There's been problems. A lot of congressmen moved out of C Street. Senator John Thune of South Dakota moved out of C Street. He wants to run for president. That's not a good address anymore. Bart Stupak moved out. He called it a stink bomb, not because he opposed it politically, but because it was causing tough questions to be asked. Senator Ensign, of course, moved out. Senator Mark Pryor, a Democrat from Arkansas, anti-gay, anti-reproductive rights, anti-labor, anti-healthcare, pro-war Democrat from Arkansas. He had a couple years ago explained to me bipartisanship. He said this. He'd learned this in the family. Bipartisanship means Jesus didn't come to take sides. He came to take over. Well, I got to reporting that, and that was awkward for the senator. And after the C Street scandals, he really didn't want to be involved and ended up having a conversation with his staff, who said, just please stop associating us with this. We don't want to have anything to do with it anymore. That's not a profile in courage, but at least it's going in the right direction. I think that's all good. But, again, transparency. And I think this is important, especially for liberal folks, to remember that phrase, the noise of democracy. Look at it, someone like the late Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or James Dobson, these Christian right leaders. Some of you, maybe most of you, disagree with a lot of their views, but it's easy to disagree with their views because you know what they are. They go out and they argue for them in the public square. I'm not calling to keep religion out of the public square, just the opposite. I want to hear it. If you're going to govern from a religious place, tell us about it. Let us have that debate. So I those guys, those fundamentalist ministries, the Falwells and the Robertsons, they're bringing the noise of democracy too. Even the Tea Party. The Tea Party is bringing noise, and there is a very democratic element foundation. Let's hope they can hold on to that and don't lose hold of it. Just their desire to be in the public square, and I think that's the outcome that I would like to see for the family. I would like to see transparency. I think when you get to that point of transparency, the kinds of influence you see in countries like Uganda that are very dangerous, that's going to wither away.
Jeff Charlotte, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Charlotte is author of the New York Times bestseller, The Family, and the book we're discussing tonight, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Thanks to our audience here and on the radio. I am Angie Coiro, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.